Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chum, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community.
This is Season 14 of the White Book Podcast.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to, what is this, I've got it written down somewhere, episode 517
of
the White Book slash Props and Slops. So.
Yeah. It's a lot of episodes, Will.
Boy, isn't it? Yeah. It's a lot of episodes, but we keep trucking along at a slower pace than we used to, but nobody has complained yet.
No one has complained yet. Well, they'll probably complain about this episode because they don't get their weekly dose or bi-weekly or tri-weekly or however many we're putting these episodes out. They don't get their usual dose of Aaron Glazer.
Indeed. We lost Roy early in the prior episode.
Not by choice.
Sure. I just meant, you know, so now we're trading and we're going to let Aaron peace out for the night and, you know, make Roy talk.
It's true. I tried to talk. The problem last time I was on one of these was not me. Like always, the problem is not me for a lack of trying.
For sure. Or lack of talking.
I cannot stop myself despite personal and professional damage that has done to me countless times. I cannot stop myself.
Has podcasting done personal or professional damage to you?
No, but
okay.
Whew. The talking is what I'm saying. The talking.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. The talking.
Although I guess technically, not this podcast, but I guess technically the history podcast I used to do did professional damage to me. So that is, but that's a story for another time. But
sure.
So we're back for Props and Slops. It's going to be weird to not have Glazers. I guess I'm actually the contrarian on this show when it comes to like opinions on things. So,
man,
it's going to be interesting to do this.
Yeah. Sometimes, I don't know. It's weird. We all have our topics, I suppose. For instance, you know, the 90s British Wave comic writers, I think we're nearly all contrarians on that front at this point. So
I think so. Yeah, I wouldn't say we're contrarians at that, because I think that I think we have our camps, but we're not like I don't think any of the opinions that we have are like outside of like the mainstream. You know what I mean? Like
that's fair. Yeah, they're not like particularly hot takes.
Yeah,
axes. I mean, we want to continue to grind.
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, when it comes to mid-90s to mid-2000 comics, I will never put those axes down. They will always be sharpened. I will never forget one more day, no matter. And every time,
oh Lord,
I forget
I
about
wish
one
I could.
More day.
I would make a deal with Mephisto to forget one more day.
Well, I'll be honest. I actually have forgotten it a few times, but then when I remember it, it then makes me just white hot angry all over again. Like I'm experiencing it. So if it was just like constantly, like roiling in my psyche, that would actually be better because there are some things that I can like never not remember. For example, the end of Game of Thrones. Like I can never just like not remember the last season. And like when my students like are like watching it, they're like they'll like know I used to be obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm.
And like they like want to talk about it. I'm like, I don't want to talk about this. Like you don't want my opinions. Like then they'll like start talking. I'm like, I gotta stop, but I can't because it just comes out. It's just constantly roiling in my psyche. But sadly, One More Day doesn't do that. So that just, again, it's like, you know, an addict that has been clean for, you know, so many years, but when they're reminded,
you get that hit.
Yeah. So anyway, One More Day, terrible. One of the worst comic book stories I've ever read. But there were so many bad ones in that time period that it's hard to disentangle all of them.
They were so bad. And yet so many of them, like, I liked at the time. Like, I'm not going to lie. I liked, you know, Identity Crisis when it came out.
No.
And it wasn't until later that, you know, the cracks were pointed out to me. And I was like, oh yeah. Good point.
I wanted to like Identity Crisis because I met the writer. He actually came on our college radio show, which I still don't understand how my friend scored that almost 20 years ago. It would be 19 years ago, probably. Like, it will have been like fall 2004, I think, is when it came on. And Brad Meltzer was on our radio show.
What?
Promoting his book, and he was like, I have this comic series coming out too. We were like in awe of him, and that was for Green Arrow. I was like, I really wanted to like Brad Meltzer, like, because I met him personally, and he was a nice man. I'm sure he's perfectly nice. And I like read the first issue. I was all right, yeah, okay, cool, go Brad. Like, I liked his Green Arrow book too, and then the stuff that happened later, and it's just recently been like, oh, stop, why must you do this to us all?
It's these big events that just have to set up a new status quo and really, you know, shake everything up. They've got to get edgy to do that, it seems. And then
the one of that era I liked Infinity Crisis when it came out.
I honestly still like Infinite Crisis. I think it's the best of those kind of modern events that I can recall off the top of my head.
I don't think you're wrong about that statement, Will, but that is not a compliment. Like
it's more damning the others.
It's just more damning the others. Like, I'm sorry. Like, Superboy punching the walls of reality as an excuse for why stuff.
That was the most, like,
is wrong.
Unapologetically comic book-y thing. And I loved that. I soaked that up. That was the, like, Silver Age silliness coming through. And I liked that.
It's not silvery. It's just the ultimate Geoff Johns thing. Because at first you're like, oh yeah, that's like just like this really cool use of this character that like most people forgot about. And then you get to level two of Geoff Johns where you're like, oh, it's this like meta commentary of like fanboys getting so upset about changes. So the ultimate fanboy, Superboy, Golden Age Superboy is causing all these problems by being so upset about the changes. And then you get to level three and you're like, this is so dumb. I'm sorry. It's just like the laziest form of storytelling in the world. It's like, and it just shows Geoff Johns' like pedantic willingness to like refashion things. And like I use this metaphor a lot because I actually think it's very apt, but there are definitely some writers that you don't want the eye of Sauron of them to like point at your favorite character. And Geoff Johns is definitely one of them. He's up there with like Dave Fioni. Like if your favorite character like gets under Geoff Johns' eyes, you're like, oh no. Oh, what horrible thing is Geoff Johns gonna earnestly try to shove down your throat about this character? But what else bad crossovers that era? Infinite Crisis. Oh, what was the one that
happened? Civil War didn't age well. And Civil War 2 was really
That was years later though. But I can't believe that was Bendis' last thing he did at Marvel. Let's see. That era was Infinite Crisis, Civil War, Death of Captain America, which was an interesting experience working in a comic book store when that was happening. Let's see. Secret Invasion, which was hot garbage. About to get the TV show.
Let's see. Would Marvel Zombies count?
I mean,
the original would have been back then.
Right. It wasn't like an event. It did change comics.
Yeah.
Not for the better. I hate Marvel Zombies and the whole concept.
Original Sin, probably.
Original Sin's later.
Is that maybe a little later?
That's a Jason Aaron era.
We could probably this era Ultimatum ending. In that era, right?
No. Well, maybe Ultimatum. For me, the end of this era is either Avengers versus X-Men or Hickman's Secret Wars. Like, I personally more think it's Avengers versus X-Men. It kind of ends that era of like Marvel, but like I'm willing to accept like Hickman like Secret Wars is like ending that era of like early 20th century Marvel, which goes so it goes up to like what 2015. So it's like 15 years of Marvel from like the ultimate from a, basically from Marvel Knights to Hickman kind of rebooting the universe, but kind of not in that classic like Hickman way. But like of that like peak era, House of M, Avengers Disassembled.
I forgot about Let's not forget that one. More Mutants.
Yeah. Avengers Disassembled. Let's not forget that one. That was terrible. Spider-Man, Gwen Stacy being having secret kids with Norman Osborn since past. That storyline.
Back on the DC side, Final Crisis then would probably
Final Crisis, Identity Crisis, Infinite Crisis. What was the one between Infinite Crisis and Final Crisis?
Oh, crap. That one did not have a crisis name. Oh, was that? That would have been when Flashpoint was, I think, right?
Oh, Flashpoint. Flashpoint was really bad. Like, and they made a whole ass movie. Okay, wait, you haven't seen it, so
I have not yet.
I will not say
anything. Hopefully soon. Anyway.
Flashpoint. Oh man, so many bad crossovers. Oh, there's some Batman ones I'm missing, I'm sure, from this era. I mean, my favorite is No Man's Land, which I keep wanting to buy. The trade paperbacks are so expensive. And like, I want to buy them, Will, and I spend a lot of money on stupid shit that I don't spend on, like Magic the Gathering cards. But I can't quite get myself to do it. Like, I just, like, every time I'm like, one day, though, one day. One day. So I can reread it and see if it holds up. Because I fucking ate up No Man's Land. Like, ate it up. I read, like, every issue. They're probably actually somewhere in my parents' house, so maybe I should just go dig those up. But anyway, that was a hell of a digression.
That was. And, you know, it actually reminded me of something that is still a digression, but is tangentially related. So we did some family stuff over the weekend, and we're at a cousin's house with kiddos and stuff. So they pretty much always have a kids movie of some kind playing on Disney Plus or something while we're there. Even though, like, none of the kids are paying attention, they're
of course, that's playing, the way it works.
But yeah, it's on anyway. So they had the Toy Story movies playing in sequence. And then I realized Joss Whedon wrote Toy Story. Not alone. That? There were like three credits, but he was named number one and it blew my mind. I never knew that.
That was one of the ways he like made his like career as like a golden child of the like mid to late 90s. It was Buffy, plus he wrote the Toy Story script. He did rewriting on X-Men, the original X-Men movie, yeah. Too.
The Bryan Singer stuff.
The original Bryan Singer movie. So
I feel like I hear like 90% about Buffy when people, you know, were talking about things. Maybe 10% about X-Men and 0% about Toy Story. maybe nobody wants Toy Story poisoned for them in retrospect. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, Whedon. Oh, Josh. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, well, moving speaking on from that. Of overrated wastes of my time, like Infinite Crisis, wow. Let's talk about the Ted Lasso finale, which I put off 3 weeks of watching it. And until last week, when I thought we were doing an episode of this, I was like, at work. Hopefully no one at work is listening to this.
And, then maybe your talking will get you in trouble.
Yeah. Things are slow. And so I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to watch this Ted Lasso finale. So I propped my phone up against my laptop and watched it. And it sucked. It was really bad. It was like really bad. Like it was poisonously bad. Like up there with Game of Thrones. Like of just like I left that series that I had. Not as much of a feeling, but like the first season of Ted Lasso, I really enjoyed like a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, I actively do not like Ted Lasso now. Like,
wow.
Both the character and the show. So
that's impressive. I didn't like. Do I feel like they stuck the landing? No, not really. But wow, my reaction is not that intense by any means. Wow. So let's unpack that? I mean, beyond the fact that I think they wanted to put a neat bow on literally everything except for off the top
literally
of my
everything.
Head. Off the top of my head now, the only one I remember is they left it ambiguous about Ted and Michelle at the end, but not that ambiguous.
I mean, like ambiguous in the sense that you can either interpret it that they got back together, or you can interpret it that they've like come to peace and they have a healthy like relationship, like, you know, as co-parents.
Right.
Like they're in a good place, whether you want to interpret that as that good place, meaning they are romantically involved again, or that, you know, they're just good co-parents who are friends.
They might be. I don't know. They definitely, it was not lost on me, the framing of the scenes of, I can't think of Ted's son now, of him and Michelle watching the game with the therapist not paying attention on his phone. And then he's like doing something else in the kitchen. And like every time it flashed back, he's like more and more disconnected further and further from them. So,
oh yeah, yeah.
You know, it was kind of neat to see them like visually representing that, but it was also like, hey, here's another one of those things that we're just gonna like super fast forward through at the end because we did not really plan out the final season very well.
No, we did not. Yeah, we did not. I mean, all right, let me say some things I liked about the finale.
Okay,
let's start with that. I liked where the team ended up. Like, I think having them win the game, but lose, like come in second.
Yeah.
It was a good, like, that was a good ending, right? Where you get both the emotional payoff of that soccer game mattering and a lot of tension. And, but the, you know, it's just not like a perfect sports ending where, yeah, they also get to our number one in the Champions League. Woo! It's like, okay. They had an amazing season. It's still a great sports story, and it's possible to like achieve goals, but still fall short. I thought that was really good. I thought that was like compelling while also like not being saccharine. Like so much of this was. I liked the storyline with Krim. Is it? What's his first name?
Trent Krim. Independent.
I felt the Trent Krim storyline of the season was one of like the better storylines.
Of the season.
I'm glad that there was actual soccer in this episode. And for me saying that, like, this show forgot for about two seasons that it was, you know,
they did
at least 30% a sports show. And you should use the sport you're supposed to be protecting to like drive the drama forward. They didn't. This is the only episode. No, I guess there's the episode where they play West Ham before.
Yeah. There was that, and there were a couple bits, notably the string bit at practice, like that. I would.
Yeah, that was stuff. That joke was a joke that overstayed itself. Welcome, like that was a bad. That was not good. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Well, the previous episode also, I guess, had a little bit with the, like, where they played Manchester. Like, that also had some, like, tension. But
yeah. But it didn't really show us much of the game, as far as I recall. Yeah. It was more kind of the setup and the question of how Jamie would deal with kind of being on his home turf and then the fans being crappy. And that was kind of it.
Yeah. But they weren't crappy in the end.
In the end, just like everybody, other than that, else, except for Rupert, who is
Rupert
not getting irredeemable.
Rupert not getting redeemed. That's another good thing. But other than that, basically hated every other moment of the episode.
Yeah,
it was really bad, like really bad, like actively terrible.
A good thing that he was not, but also still, I feel like his actions there at the end felt like a fast forward, like. We've never seen Rupert lose kind of his composure or self-control, even like when Ted beat him at darts and things like that. Like there was no particular development or push, I thought, to that kind of wild overreaction. It just, it felt like a different evil character than the Rupert we've seen so far.
Yeah. I mean, there was clearly like, it felt like there was like an episode only about West Ham that just didn't air, like that they like wrote and that then just like threw out
a lot, particularly Nate's storyline and redemption. That probably would have helped a lot.
It would have. Like, I definitely feel like they wrote an episode of like this and they just deleted it. Because it feels like that, because there's like beats that like assume you know things that happened,
mm-hmm.
but they're just not there. Like, it just honestly feels like that.
Yeah.
It's like Nate's storyline is just like so botched by the end.
Yeah. Yeah. It now that you're saying that, really, we go from the end of one episode, we see him at the party where he kind of has his realization that he doesn't actually want what Rupert is offering. And then the next episode, we see him like working at the Greek restaurant. And it's like, wait a minute.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's just like really bad. Like really bad. Like, it is up there with Game of Thrones. It's just like so incredibly disappointing. Like, the Keely, Roy, and Jamie storyline. Like, I have
also not clearly resolved either.
Well, it is. They're not together. Like, she's not with either of those men, which is totally fine. Like, the fact that they decided to be like, Keely is like independent and Roy needs to work on himself and Jamie needs to be, I don't know, work with his dad.
You can definitely make that assumption. It's like Ted and Michelle. Like, that's not.
I think it's way less
stated. And she's clearly at the party at the end, like, with Roy's niece, I can't think of her name, like on her lap and that sort of thing.
But she was always friendly with her, including the first episode of the season.
Sure, sure. I'm just saying, like, they didn't clearly state it. If they'd wanted to, especially when Roy and Jamie show up at her place, they could have actually shown her response. But they deliberately did not want to actually, like, disappoint anybody.
She could be in a triad with them. Like, it is.
Seen that theory.
Yeah, I'm sure there's tons of people who believe that theory. More power to them. I hope they get a little enjoyment out of that.
I mean, but it's healthier than her and Jack were.
That's true. I have zero problem, though, with them ending it with they're not together or in a triad, or even if she ended up with Jamie, whatever. But the fact that Roy and Jamie get in a fight and that's their storyline in the last episode over Keely is like so dumb and so out of nowhere, like just out of nowhere, right? That they just get in a physical fight with each other and they both like play this like one-upsmanship game thing. It's just like so against where they were going with the characters the entire season.
They reverted to season one versions of themselves.
Yeah. And it was just like very unsatisfying. And you're just like, okay, like particularly because it's like, oh, it looks like, oh, they're going to like put their toxic masculinity aside and be friends and Keely can make whatever choice she wants to make. No, I mean, that's kind of where they end up. But we get to go through this whole rigmarole of them like fighting. It's not even funny. Like, it's just bad. Like, it's just bad and poorly cooked, like super poorly cooked. Like, whatever the fundamental writing and character problems of this season, like, something clearly went wrong in their processes this season. Like,
I will say most of the things that we've been talking about are kind of the big picture, you know, character arcs and completions and such. And that I think they definitely dropped the ball on, but I think kind of the smaller attention to detail, long running gag payoff stuff, I think they handled much better. Probably because some of that stuff was planned in, you know, season one, episode one. And now they were like, ah, here's the moment to drop that revelation. Things like Willis is Beard's first name, which is said in, I think, episode one, where Ted says, "What you talking about, Willis?" And you think it's just a reference to, what is that, Different Strokes?
Different Strokes.
Yeah. But then it turns out that is actually Beard's first name. Or the lads at the bar, who I can't remember any of their names except for Paul. But I had never connected until seeing their names on the stock ticket that they are PB&J.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Cute. Or stuff like the photo that May straightens at the end there being the same one that what's his name straightens on the final episode of Cheers.
So
it's a callback to another, you know, great sitcom, whatever.
Sure.
But in the context of Cheers, that photo was a tribute to Coach, the original owner. So now it's like double layered because, of course, Ted's a coach and so on. Like that type of stuff, I think they did really well. But I got the impression that stuff had been planned for a long time.
It's also small potato stuff.
Oh, sure. Small sure. Stuff.
But I will have to turn in my millennial white male card because I hated Ted Lasso by the end. So I have to turn it in to the white police, I guess. And because I just hate Ted Lasso. So,
yeah. I'm going to not make any of the jokes that spring to mind at the moment because all of them are in poor taste. So moving on.
All right. Talk about Star Trek.
Yeah. So I didn't actually realize till earlier today that season 2 of Strange New Worlds has dropped. And I absolutely loved season 1. I already really liked Anson Mount in general. He was the one redeeming thing in Inhumans, for instance. And I think he's made a phenomenal Captain Pike. I really love his rendition. The rest of the crew's been great. The more opposite of serialized, more kind of self-contained episodes has been refreshing to me in this era of television. And season 2 so far, only one episode's out so far because they are doing weekly, is just more of the same. And yeah, I ate it up. There's a lot of stuff coming up in that episode with the Klingons. And it was a bit amusing to me that they seem to have maybe just totally ignored what Discovery tried to do with the Klingons. What else? They introduce a new engineer who I'm interested to see where she goes. She's played off as maybe being a little bit not all together there. Kind of the, you know, wise old sage that might be off the rocker, like, I don't know, Yoda in the original trilogy kind of thing. It's the lady, I can't think of the actress's name, but she played the Ghost of Christmas Present in Scrooged, if anybody remembers that, or the landlady in Kimmy Schmidt.
Vaguely remember that.
Yeah.
Vaguely.
Yeah, kind of crazy curly hair and just pulls off that not all together there zany kind of thing off really well. So it's interesting. She's some new race that has not appeared in Star Trek before. That it sounds like maybe is immortal and she's just kind of bored. So that's why she wants to be on the Enterprise, is it seems exciting. So yeah, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you finally saw Guardians of the Galaxy?
I did. I finally saw it. I fell far behind. And I know we already chatted some on the show about it before, but I know in particular, you did not say much because you didn't want to spoil things for me. So feel free to open up again here. I'll say it felt like a reasonable cap on the Guardians trilogy. Passing the torch to Rocket made sense, and the new team of Guardians and so on. There was a good chunk of that film that I discovered a new trigger. There's like 30 to 40% of that film is all.
I don't actually think it's quite that high.
It is.
Body horror in general. Yeah.
And a lot of it is the animals.
Yes.
And just really dwelling on that. And I spent a sizable portion of the film staring at my lap because that was all I could do. So that was odd. I actually caught part of Ant-Man 1 again on TV the other day.
Oh.
And it struck me when I watched that, because it shows what's his name, Yellow Jacket, whatever his civilian name is.
Experiment. Darren Cross.
Yes, it shows Darren Cross. Pardon me. Trying to kind of perfect the shrinking tech, right? And it's not working. And you see him run it on, I think it was a cow or something like that, that just shrinks and goes, and like, that's it. It's over in a matter of 2 seconds and it's gone. And like, you're aware of what happened and aware that it's not good, but like, it doesn't dwell on it. And I feel like Guardians could have and probably should have tackled things in that type of manner. But Guardians really dwelled on it. And it made me uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, the movie fucked me up. Like both emotionally, I was extremely impacted by the themes of the movie, but just like the animal abuse was like a lot. Like, it was like a whole lot. Like, yeah, but, and like, I knew what was happening. Like, about, like, because there were two options, right, with Rocket's friends. Mm-hmm. They were either dead or they were, like, captured by the High Evolutionary and, like, Rocket was going to have to save them. And they could either be, like, tragically die at that point or Rocket could be reunited with them, right?
Right.
And the scene where they're all, like, laughing, I was like, oh, they're all going to die. Like, I was like, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. That's the version of this story that Duck Gunn is going to do. And, like, when his friends die, I, like, bawled. Like, I just, like, cried. Like, cried my eyes out. Like, just absolutely cried. Like, the movie.
I don't blame you at all. Especially, like, man, the creepy rabbit that was just, like, clearly not mentally there the way the others were, and it just
I thought he was cute. He like meant well. Like,
no, it did, but it just made it so much more like painful and disturbing to me because the rabbit's kind of personality was so pure, and it just
that's fair. Yeah, it was probably one of my favorite post Endgame Marvel movies, like legitimately ones. I think I actually probably, I mean, I'll have to rewatch it when it comes on Disney Plus in a few weeks to say, but like, I felt like I did feel satisfied that it sort of summed up things that all sort of three and a half Guardians movies. Cause like, you got 1, 2, Infinity War is like half a Guardians movie.
Sure.
And then the special, which was terrible. Like, I actually thought this movie was going to be bad because the special was terrible. Like, honest to goodness, felt like a waste of time. And it is a waste of time, except for revealing that Peter and Mantis are siblings.
Yeah.
Which is kind of important to this movie, but also not. So, like,
yeah, mostly not, I think.
Particularly the decision Mantis makes at the end, which I get, like, I kind of get where they're going with that, But it definitely felt more like the actress wants a break and doesn't want to be under Disney obligations.
Well, that way she can go work for Warner Brothers DC.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I know nothing. I'm just assuming, you know,
but we're still going to see
some folks cross over. You know,
oh, yeah.
Thinking of her does remind me of something else that really kind of disturbed me in the movie. Two things, but one is related to Mantis. And we already brought up Identity Crisis earlier. Was anyone else really disturbed that the way Drax got Dr. Lighted, so to speak, and the movie just moves on and does not at all care about any consequences or any moral or ethical quandary to the fact that, like, Nebula and Mantis just, like, deeply emotionally wounded Drax. And then Mantis just says, forget, and makes him forget it, and they just move on.
I actually forgot that happened in the movie, so.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it does.
No, yeah, yeah, I'm sure it does.
That was awkward. That was awkward. Also, another bit less, you know, ethically creepy than that, but it's played for laughs. I feel the way it's framed that way, and the people to the left of me in the theater definitely laughed, both at that part and when they are rescuing all of the kids off of the high evolutionary ship, which I'm really depressed it wasn't named Mount Wundagore, but whatever. And then all the animals. There's a resident of nowhere who we keep seeing kind of in the front corner of shots who's helping with everything. And then as the animals come out, this monkey, this enraged monkey, leaps out and attaches to her face and starts attacking, clawing, biting, whatever, like Rocket did to the high evolutionary earlier.
Oh.
And it just like threw me for a loop. Like, it's framed like it should be funny, and people in our theater laughed, but I'm like, what the, every second of screen time we've seen of this lady, she's a friend, she's helping with the evacuation, and now she is being horribly mauled, maybe killed. What? Hmm.
I don't know. I also missed that, so.
It was not, you know, dead center of the frame or anything, but it, yeah, I don't know. It was weird.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I'll have to rewatch it more closely. I was just so affected by a lot of the thematic stuff that I might have missed some of those things. So, but yeah, I really like Guardians 3. Like, again, I would probably give it like an A. Hmm. Like, hard prop. You should definitely see it. I mean, the main thing is, like, if you have animal abuse triggers, you should, like, a friend of mine, my coworker of mine, like, she was gonna take her kids on who are like 9, 7, 6. I was like, you're gonna have to cover their like eyes for like a good part of it, like, because
I don't blame them there.
So yeah.
Oof. I can't go that high. I think the only post Endgame film that I give that rating to is probably still Shang-Chi.
Wow, not even the Spider-Man one.
Okay, yeah, it was pretty good. Maybe I give it an A as well. It was such a different vibe, though. It was, you know, this kind of bittersweet conclusion. But Shang-Chi just maintained that like fun early Marvel vibe all the way through, while still feeling fresh. I don't know, but yeah, Guardians. I mean, a good chunk of this is just riding on the back of, wow, I would have filmed or cut things way differently, but I'm giving it like C+, B- range.
Okay. Wow. All right. Wow. Okay. Well, we're very far apart on this film, but that's fine.
I admit my reaction may be colored by, you know, content issues, but oh well.
Yeah. I'll speed through these two things real quick. So for those of you who are a big British detective drama fan in the US, Endeavor, the Inspector Morse prequel series, its final season, which aired in the UK earlier this year, is now, or I guess last year, but anyway, in 2022, maybe early 2023, Jesus Christ, time. It moves in a different direction. Is now here. It's the final season. It's good. It's really good. Endeavor, I was talking to my wife about this. Inspector Morse, the original show, is pure gold. Even its bad episodes all have something going for them, and Peter Thaw as Inspector Morse is always would watch and have watched countless hours of Inspector Morse. Endeavor is a little bit more over the place. When it's really good, it's almost as good as the original series. When it's really bad, it's really bad. And you're like, why am I watching this? What? Like, why is this charming? Why is this? I wouldn't describe Inspector Morse / Endeavor as charming. Why is this low stakes British detective show stopping an atomic accident? I don't know. The writers decide.
What?
Yeah, that's the. Oh, hold on one second. Let me look it up real quick. It's the fourth season. Let me see real quick. Hold on. I had actually the Endeavor. It's the fourth season, yes, which was, I think, the worst season of the show. No. The worst season of the show is season 7, which has the most convoluted plot in the entire world, which I won't even explain, like, just how stupid it is, Will. But it's, like, so epically stupid that I got to the end of it and I was like, wow, I'm glad Sean Evans has an awesome mustache, because if he didn't, it would be entirely unwatchable. But anyway, back to series 9.
It's just the mustache, okay?
It's just the mustache. Season 9, the mystery was good in the pilot. The characterization was good. Sean Evans is doing that thing that, oh my God, who's the actor? Ewan McGregor did in Revenge of the Sith, where he's like slowly acting more like Alec Guinness. Revenge of the Sith. Like, he's doing this thing where he's doing a lot of the tics that Peter Thaw would do as, like, old Morse in the original series to, like, show that he's getting closer to, like, where the character is.
Yeah, that's cool.
When the Morse show picks up. So it's really good if you enjoy this kind of stuff. Or if you are like me and have been watching Endeavor since 2013, which is a weird thing to say, but is a thing I have been doing. Wow. It is hopefully a fitting finale. We'll see. There's still 2 more episodes, obviously, over the next 2 weeks, but, I've enjoyed it a lot. And then, I went today, I came home from work very early after watching Endeavor and doing chores and running some errands. I went on like a Amazon Prime, like mystery show, bottomless pit, where I found all kinds of garbage that I will watch over the summer. And report back to everyone. And I'm sure Aaron will be just so happy to listen to me, because I know he just truly loves it when I talk about these shows. Like, I know it warms his heart, and he definitely does not start playing Marvel Snap as soon as I start talking when we do these episodes.
I mean, you need to point us toward a few of those. Now that I've got Kristen to open up to the Hallmark, murders and mysteries or whatever they're called, I feel like it's not much further to go into some of these kind of British cozy mystery type things.
Then you should do Midsommar Murders.
Okay.
That's your speed. That's your speed.
Okay.
Midsommar Murders is your speed. Like, it's like 2 steps above a Hallmark mystery. Like,
okay.
It has real actors, like, who are talented. But the screenwriting is like,
are you
about
Danica McKellar? She's winning, man.
The fact that the best of those is actually the lady from Melrose Place who does the crossword mysteries is like, that is a statement of the state of Hallmark.
I was actually
flipping. Tom Selleck.
I was flipping through some of those just last night, and I realized Jewel, the singer, actually stars in a series of them. I don't remember the name of the series now, though.
I don't know either. I could look it up. Maybe I will over the summer. But my plan is, there's a Tom Selleck series that I think originally was on Hallmark, and it's on Amazon right now. And I was like, all right, on Monday, my first day of summer, this is how I'm going to start my summer. If I'm not super addicted to Final Fantasy 16, that's a possibility, where all I'm doing is playing Final Fantasy 16. But if I'm not addicted to Final Fantasy 16, I'm just going to sit. I'm going to wake up. at like 9 a.m. We'll watch like 12 hours of these Tom Selleck movies and kick off my summer in style with the dog. But anyway, this is actually not where my point was going. My point was I remembered this 90s lawyer drama that my mother and I watched called Murder One. Okay. And I said to myself, does this exist on Amazon? And it does, but you have to pay for it. And it doesn't exist for free anywhere. So I spent $9 to get the first season, which is what my mother and I watched together. And Ala and I watched two and a half episodes of it before I started to do the show. And it is a joy. Love 90s. It's like so 90s. And like, it's just so 90s, from the sound design to the costuming to the cultural assumptions that go on. It's amazing. And the mystery so far is fine. But it's more like watching old Law & Order, which is another thing we do. Because for my birthday, I bought the Law & Order box set that has every episode of the original series. Ooh. We're in the 1994 season currently. It's a journey of cultural, like, change. And we've just reached the Giuliani years of New York, and things are already changing. It's great. And anyway, A+. So if you want some 90s lawyer show nostalgia, Murder One, which is just $9.79, that's what I paid on Amazon, which I think for 23 episodes, I think that's pretty good value.
Yeah.
I cannot recommend enough. But of course, you have to have patience of a 90s drama that really is so thirsty for Emmys. Like, you feel like Emmys are just going to fall out of your TV. Last crime show that I've been watching. I talked about it before in the show. Joe Pickett, based on some novels. It's about a fish and a wildlife dude in Wyoming? Yeah, I think it's Wyoming. It's Wyoming and Montana. First season was good, sometimes great, but mostly good. The current season has been bad to sometimes good. It's trying to adapt a story where hunters are getting killed like they are being hunted. So, like, you know, when they get killed, they're like strung up like you would string up like a deer.
Oh, okay.
And that's like the mystery they're supposed to be solving. But it keeps getting distracted by like the most annoying and stupid and tropey subplots that I'm like, why? Like, this mystery is perfectly fine. And you have some like interesting, compelling drama going on. But you like, do you need a bunch of weird backwoods cannibal brothers that are like running around and beating up the protagonist? No. Like, did I need two episodes of that to start the season? No, I did not need that. Like, it has like, and his memory isn't trustworthy, and it's just like, and he like hallucinates. It's just like all these tropes I hate were like dumped into the first three episodes and keep coming back. I'm just like, am I going to stop watching this? Probably not, because the summer is about to start and I'll watch lots of things over the summer that I normally wouldn't, but I'm on the verge of giving up on it. And I really like the first season. I thought the first season was very satisfying. So it's a little disappointing. But that is the end. So that one I'll slop. Hard prop Murder One and prop Endeavor. You and I don't read, Will. So let's talk about video games.
We used to read. We used to.
I keep promising myself I'm going to read more, but that's a lie. It's a lie.
Oh, man. Well, who knows? You've got your vacation coming up. Maybe. Maybe one day.
Maybe one day.
Well, for me, I don't know that I really have anything exciting to report yet on it, just that Diablo 4 is out and I'm playing, and I've yet to really devote a ton of time to it. I think I'm like level 21 or something, maybe 22 now, so you can tell I've not put all that much time in. In fact, I'm still in Act 1. And thanks to the wonders of cross-platform play and my Battle.net friends list, I can see, you know, what my other acquaintances are doing. And I'm seeing friends at, like, level 42 playing Act 5 right now.
Oh, geez. And I think, how many acts are there?
I have to assume that 5 is the last one, right?
I have no idea. Probably.
Just a
guess. Sounds about right.
So I'm thinking to myself that I have probably spent too much time on side quests. It's a very
probably
side quest heavy MMO light-ish game. And it is very easy for me to get sucked down the side quest rabbit hole. I mean, you're talking to the guy who well and truly strip mined every planet in the galaxy in Mass Effect. So I don't know when I'll get around to beating this game. Maybe
wow, you strip mined every planet. Wow, in Mass Effect 2?
And 3, for that matter. But yeah.
Oh, and 3? Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's more. Well, actually, 3 is less tedious. 2 is the most tedious.
Yeah, well, 3 wasn't bad, but you do also have to dodge Reapers and stuff.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I think 3, I got everything in 3. But you don't have to, like, land on any planets unless it's, like, a quest. And you don't have to, like, open up your, like, thing and scan and be like,
yeah,
anomaly detected.
Yeah, anomaly. You don't have to blow nearly as much time on that as you did in 2. But 2's where I started it.
Anomaly detected. Sorry. Yeah. I have the trauma.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's fine. Now you're just making me think, though, about the dulcet tones of the codex. And, man, I could listen to that all night. So anyway, that's where I am with Diablo 4. I'm actually taking a personal day off of work on Friday to devote to video gaming. So we'll see where I am at the end of that.
All right. Well, good luck. I know a lot of our contemporary millennials mm-hmm. are engaging in a lot of nostalgia about Diablo. And I will never be caught dead playing another Diablo game after Diablo 3, which was one of the single worst playing experiences of my life. And
just boot up Diablo 2 again. You'll be fine.
Yeah. But I mean, I was a Diablo obsessive, not as much as like StarCraft, but like, I really did love Diablo 2, but like, not to the point where I want to go back anymore. Like, Diablo 3 is just so soured me, but it was just part of a broader, like, Blizzard sucks, like, thing. I think Diablo 3 was the moment where I was like, I need to stop playing Blizzard games that aren't like Hearthstone, which doesn't have a storyline, because I'm just going to come to realize that all these games were bad and all their stories were bad. And I only loved them because I was a sixth grader when StarCraft came out or whatever it was. And I thought StarCraft was so cool rather than just like a Warhammer 40K reskin. But whatever. But speaking of reskins, I played a game that is a American-made JRPG called Path of the Midnight Sun, which is an indie game that started its life as a reskin of Fire Emblem 8, which is Fire Emblem Sacred Stones. It was a ROM hack of that game that it started life as in 2014 when Barack Obama was still president. And the guy got it kickstarted and turned it into a real video game. It's good, actually. Like, there's voice acting, which is super weird when you think about it. When you think about this game's origin. You can definitely see where it started its life as a Sacred Stones reskin. But it's overall just like a really good single A JRPG, like that's like clearly been made with like the most upgraded version of RPG Maker, but the person like pushes RPG Maker engine to like its extreme. It does make a few choices that are kind of annoying. For example, when you get into the battle map where you like walk around and then there's like encounters, you can't go and view your inventory until you clear that map. So like you can't like change your skills or like use items outside of combat, except like you can only, you know, do things. You can either walk around the map or do combat or suspend your game so that you can like walk away from your computer if you have to. Like you can't, you know, change your loadout if you're like, oh, you realized after like halfway through that your loadout was bad. You have to either try to beat the whole thing with the bad loadout or go back to your save before you did this. You also can't save before bosses. Ooh, which is really annoying.
Bummer.
So you have to be like a little bit careful because if you die, you have to do the whole thing over again. But the story is like really good for an indie RPG. And the core systems are good. Combat is fine to good sometimes. I kind of started to figure out like what its core gameplay loops are. And they're pretty enjoyable. Like I think it's like the kind of enjoyable where if you don't like try to do everything on a map, you'll enjoy it. But if you're just like every single map, you're like, I'm going to kill every enemy. You'll get really sick. Like you'll get sick of it. Cause the game does do a good job of like, you do one of these like maps that's filled with like somewhere between 6 to 12, maybe even as high as like 20 encounters. But then it gives you like 30 minutes of none of that, maybe even 40. And then you do another map. So like you like clear your brain, if that makes sense. Like you're not, it's not like, oh, you do this like tedious map with the combat and then 5 minutes of story and then another tedious map. It's spaced out, I think, really well.
Okay.
To get you like each time you go back, you're like invested a little bit more in the characters. So yeah, like it's again, like if you're a person who enjoys the indie American JRPG like genre, which I have in certain times of my life, this is a great example of it. So like I would recommend it. The other game I played is Cassette Beasts, which is basically Pokemon for adults.
Okay.
It's more gameplay loop. It's not like adult. When I say that adults, I don't mean like there's like porn or whatever in it.
Oh no. Yeah. That was
literally like the core gameplay loop is Pokemon. Like you catch these monsters and you create a squad of them and you switch them in and they have a certain set of attacks. And then over as they level up, they get more attacks and you can add attacks and, you know, just basically Pokemon.
Are they captured on like cassette tapes? Is that
yes.
where the name
you,
comes
you
from?
You record them on your tapes.
Okay.
So like instead of throwing a Pokeball, you like stick your cassette player out and it says recording and it tries to record the monster. It's cute. Like it's a really cute game. It's like really well designed. Its aesthetic is kind of like very Stardew Valley-y. Pokemon meets Stardew Valley would be a way to describe it. It's very queer friendly, but very like just nice. It's just a really nice game. It really has that like kind of Pokemon attitude. Its aesthetic is a little bit more Shin Megami Tensei because it's like adult, but like more like the monster designs are kind of monstrous, but still have a slightly goofy edge to them. The main difference is instead of like having your like Pokemon do the fighting, you transform into the monsters yourself.
Oh.
And if your monster's knocked out, your like human form has its own separate health bar. So you're not technically defeated until they defeat all your monsters plus your own health bar. So it's super like it's interesting. It's cool. Like it's not the kind of game that I'm gonna like not like endlessly play, but I played it about 3 hours while I was feeling like kind of like lazy and like wanted something low impact, and it was great. And like next time I'm feeling that way, I'll boot it up and play it for another like 2 to 3 hours and then put it back down. Like it's a very like short to medium play session is satisfying kind of game. Kind of like I've actually found Pokemon actually is really good about that. So okay. Prop both of those games, but for different ways.
Nice.
All right. I think we did it, Will.
I think we did. Go us.
We did in under the danger zone of an hour.
That is really good for us. Look at that. 57-ish minutes.
Whew. I know. Super impressive. I mean, I looking at the statistics for the other podcast that I do with Aaron, Snap mm-hmm. Judgments, most of our listeners tune out after about 1 hour. So actually, let me see. 63 minutes is the average time at which people stop listening. So
what's your average length right now?
109 minutes.
Ooh. Okay. They're making it over the 50% mark at least. So
They are. Okay. Yeah. And 71% of our listeners listen to at least 75% of an episode.
All right. Those seem like decent numbers.
They seem like it. I have no idea if they're decent or not. I find the specific like 63 minute mark thing to be interesting because I'm going to make a case to the primary person on the podcast that we should try to shoot to make our episode 63 minutes.
There you go.
So there we go. But as you know, loyal listeners of White Book / Props to Slops, that any podcast with Aaron is impossible to make under an hour. And that doesn't even include my endless talking. So
that's a fact.
It's true. It's true.
So I'm sure we'll get to break some time records whenever Aaron's back and he's able to lay into the final episode of Ted Lasso, but we'll save that for then.
We will.
All right. Well, thank you, dear listeners. I hope you have tuned in for all 59-ish minutes at this point, and we'll catch you next time. Danger zone.
Konnichiwa, bitches.